Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. We got 2 hours of open forum for you on this Tuesday afternoon, so perfect time to pick up the phone and call if you got a question you've been thinking. I want to ask those guys over there at Catholic Answers this question. 888-318-7884 is the number. Open forum means open to anyone and anything. 888-318-7884. And by anything, I mean anything today, because both hours we've got Jimmy Akin with us, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, has his own Wikipedia page. I found that out today. And the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Welcome in, Herr Kellett.
What is
Guten
that?
Tag.
Why German? What on earth? It just came. This is not related to our conversation about a certain German artist last time
it
you were on.
It is not related to that.
And I use the word artist loosely. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. You know, Jimmy, since you started in German, and Guten Tag, by the way, when you're like, you know, I would like to learn this language, where do you go? Like, is there some, like Jimmy Akin goes, you know what, I like this system, all right?
Yeah. I mean, assuming I want more than a word or two of it, if I want to systematically study a language and it's a living language, then my first stop is going to be Pimsleur.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a technique. It's called the Pimsleur method. It was invented by a linguist called Paul Pimsleur. And it has a couple of features that separate it. It has a few features that separate it from other language learning methods. One is it's all audio, and you practice it by imitating native speakers. Oh. So you listen to native speakers, and each Pimsleur lesson, which are, they're like 30 minutes long, it starts with a little dialogue between a couple of native speakers.
Okay.
And you listen to that dialogue, and then they teach you how to understand it during the course of the lesson. And in the very first lesson of each set, you know, you start with this dialogue and you have no idea what they're saying. And by the end of 30 minutes, you understand exactly what they're saying.
Oh,
very cool. Yeah, they also teach you, the very first thing they teach you is a phrase that you're going to need to know in any language you're learning, which is, excuse me. That's the very first thing you learn, because you're going to need to say excuse me a lot when you're trying to talk a language you're just learning. They also use what's called graduated interval recall, which means they initially have you learn stuff. They'll have you learn a given fact and they'll repeat it frequently at the beginning, but then they start increasing the intervals between when you get quizzed on it again. So over time, as you're learning new things, you get reminders of the stuff you already know, but they're progressively more space between them.
Oh,
but they do keep coming back. So you do get reminders. They also, and this is one of the most unique things about the Pimsleur method, is if you're learning a multi-syllable word, they teach you the end of the word first. So, for example, just to cite a simple example, I said willkommen, which means welcome to you at the beginning. And if they were teaching you willkommen in German, they would start with men, then kommen, then willkommen. And the reason they do that is this is based on actual, you know, tests that were done by Paul Pimsleur, where he found that people tend to remember the fronts of words easier, but they have a harder time remembering the backs of words.
Oh.
And so by teaching you the syllables in reverse order, it drills in the thing that's going to be the hardest for you to remember. They also expect you to use to think about what you're doing. You're not just memorizing. So for example, they'll teach you, here's how to say this to a man. And then you learn how to say it to a man. And then later they'll teach you something unrelated about talking to a woman. And then they'll say, now try to say this thing you learned earlier for a man to a woman. And you got to think about, how do you pull these two different pieces of information together to be able to say the same thing to a woman? Or they'll teach you, here's how to say this thing happened. And then later they'll teach you a little bit about saying the future tense. And then they'll say, now try to say this thing will happen. And you got to figure out how to do that. So you're actively mentally engaged in what you're doing. You're not just repeating. And it's a very successful system. It's available for a lot of living languages. Unfortunately, they don't have a Latin or New Testament Greek. They do have a Hebrew, though, and Hebrew is similar enough to biblical Hebrew that it is actually useful. Mm-hmm. I was at a conference in Detroit once. It was like a Catholic conference, and Father Pacwa and then Archbishop Raymond Burke and I were on a panel discussion together. And just for a joke, I said, well, since I'm here in Detroit, it reminds me of the great biblical saying. And then in Hebrew, I said, I'd like to get 40 gallons of gas for my car, please. And Father Pacwa, whose mouth, you know, because Detroit's the motor city.
Right.
And Father Pacwa, who speaks Hebrew fluently, his mouth just fell open.
Really? Oh, that's funny. All right. So Pimsleur is your recommended. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm glad to know it. Thanks, Jimmy.
The lines are the ones I've tried.
The lines are full now, so off we go. We're starting in Canada, Newfoundland, Canada. Colin is listening on Catholic.com. Colin, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi.
Hi.
With the concept of time travel prayer that you explore in Mysterious World episode 208, if God does allow his people to interact across time in that way, do we have a sort of time travelers, tourist paradox, or future saints? For example, we have lots of instances of private revelation where we see past saints appearing to like people and telling them about, or praying for them and all that. But do we have examples of a soul identifying itself as being from the future and saying that, like, I'm praying for you because of these things you did for me, like, and before I was born, essentially, kind of a thing?
I am not aware of any phenomenon like that has been reported. I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I would think it actually could happen because God's omnipotent, and so he can do anything he chooses. And God could choose to let someone from the future appear to someone in the past, whether that person's in heaven or not. In fact, I am aware of apparitions where something like that happens, where someone from the future is talking to someone in the past, and from the perspective of the person in the past, yeah, they're talking to someone in the future, but they didn't involve saints in heaven. They involved someone who was here on earth talking to someone in the past. And but if God can do that with people who are alive, he could certainly do that with people who are in heaven as well. I'm just not aware of any situation where that has been reported. It may very well have been reported, because I think the great majority of paranormal experiences like this don't get reported and don't get investigated. So it may well have happened. It also, even if it hasn't happened, though, it may not have happened yet, because people aren't that open to this idea. They haven't been thinking about time in this way. And we do have evidence that paranormal or supernatural experiences are correlated with what people are open to. So, for example, Cy Kellett, you may recall some stories from the Gospels where it will say Jesus couldn't do many miracles in a given town.
Right.
And why did it say he couldn't do many miracles in a given town?
Their lack of faith.
Their lack of faith, right. They were not open to Jesus doing a lot of miracles in their town, and so he didn't do very many. And in the same way, if people are closed to an experience, then they tend not to have it. And so, Colin, since you've thought of this, maybe you're open to this experience, and maybe some future saint will appear to you.
That would definitely be interesting.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
And possibly quite helpful, Colin. It tends to be when they show up. All right, well, you got us to the break, Colin. Thanks for starting us off. It's open forum, one line open. Jimmy Akin, our guest, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help.
Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2005. EWTN begins celebrating 25 years with its first family celebration in Denver, Colorado. Attendees will hear renowned speakers and can visit with the network's hosts and well-known Catholic authors.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Darren, did Carrie know that Jimmy's going to be on today? Because I got to read the ad and I want to see, I want a heads up if Carrie put anything in there, anything goofy. We'll see. All right, here we go. Still looking for that perfect Christmas gift for your loved one? Look no further. Shop.catholic.com store-wide sale has just the right item for everyone on your list. Hundreds of items at 10 to 25% off and more. We've added hundreds of new items this year, almost 200 new products in total. For those of you who speak, For those of you who speak Latin, si hic occasiones preterieris plane frustratus eris. I'd have no idea. He said, if you pass up these opportunities, you will be completely disappointed. What are you waiting for? Get on over to shop.catholic.com today and let the savings begin. I apologize to anyone who actually speaks Latin. I'm sure.
I was going
to
say, Cy Kellett, you've got a very, very interesting Latin accent.
It's called Southern California Latin. I learned it.
With heavy, with lashings of Spanish.
Oh, that's probably true, huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to go back over it. That's enough of that. Thanks, Carrie. Let's keep him in English from now on. All right, let's go to Jack in Waterford, Wisconsin, listening on WSFI. Glad you're here, Jack. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Doing okay.
I'm a Christian. By the way, I love your mysterious world. I listen to it all the time.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Lutheran. I grew up in a split house. My dad was Catholic. My mom was Lutheran. So we became Lutheran. But the question I have is, I believe in heaven. What I wrestle with is reincarnation and when people can remember past lives, especially when you have like little kids that you see that. Mm-hmm. I saw one guy that was a little kid that he remembered that he was a pilot. I think it was in World War II when he actually
the James Leininger case. That,
yes. Mm-hmm. I think his sister's still alive, and she confirmed a whole bunch of things this kid said that there's no way he could possibly know. And I wonder about things like that, like when you have deja vu moments when you're little that, you know, how would you have had that and things like that. So I guess that's what the question I had for you is, how do you explain that? Because I wrestle with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, since you mentioned that you're a fan of Mysterious World, I'll recommend a couple of episodes of that where I actually look into this question. They're episodes 275 and 276. You can get to them by going to mysterious.fm/275 and also mysterious.fm/276. In episode 275, I survey how modern reincarnation research works, and as you indicate, it tends to focus on children, because what parapsychologists and reincarnation researchers have found is that adult cases aren't really that great for a couple of reasons. One of them is adults have lived, you know, longer lives, and so they have experienced a lot more stuff, most of which they have forgotten. You know, most of us don't remember every movie we've ever seen or every book we've ever read, but there could still be information that we learned about historical periods in our memories somewhere, and it could come out without us realizing the source of the information, and we could then confuse that information for a past life memory. This source amnesia, or not knowing where the information comes from, is sometimes called cryptomnesia. In Greek, kryptos means hidden and mnesia means memory. So these would be hidden memories that we don't remember where they came from. Like, for example, Cy Kellett, what was the first time you ever heard the word apple?
Not a clue.
Yeah, see, exactly. We a lot of things we know are, you know, Cy Kellett knows the meaning of the word apple. At least I assume he does. I haven't tested him on that. But he, as an English speaker, he knows the word apple, but has no idea where he learned that. And this is true for a lot of the stuff we know. We remember the stuff, but we don't know where it came from. And because adults have these longer lives where we've been exposed to so much information, it's very hard to establish in a reported reincarnation case that someone didn't learn this at some point in their life and they've just forgotten it. In fact, there have been reported reincarnation cases where it later turned out, oh yeah, this person read a book about this and they initially just forgot they'd read a book, but the book was the real source of the information. The other reason that adult cases are problematic is a lot of them are based on hypnosis. And despite what a lot of people would have you think, hypnosis is not a magic memory aid. It actually promotes confabulation or false memories. And when reincarnation researchers have like tried to verify claims that people reported under hypnotic regression, there's a very low success rate. They're unable to verify hardly anything that people say under hypnosis. So the adult cases aren't very promising, but there are cases of children who report remembering things that happened to somebody else before the time of their birth. And the question is how to explain that. Well, that's what I deal with in episode 276 of Mysterious World, where I look at different reincarnation theories. And basically, there are three theories to explain what happens or why, you know, people like children will have these memories or apparent memories. The first category is what I call soul theories. The second is what I call residue theories. And the third are what I call psychic theories. Now, these are in addition to natural theories where you could explain the apparent memories by things like parents unintentionally coaching the child, you know, without even realizing it, or other natural ways. Like a child could have cryptomnesia. You know, they could have learned something by watching a movie and forgot it. So once you eliminate the natural explanations for these apparent memories, if there are substantial memories that go beyond what the child could just guess by random chance that turn out to be true, you could explain those memories either in terms of soul, residue, or psychic theories. A soul theory is essentially that reincarnation is true. That there is something that you could call a soul that passes from one person to another and carries those memories with it. So when one person dies, their soul leaves their body, enters a new body, and that's how the memories get there. This is not really compatible with Christianity. The book of Hebrews says that it is appointed for man once to die, and then comes judgment. And the author of Hebrews is specifically responding here to ideas about reincarnation that were around in Greco-Roman culture at the time, because there were Greeks and Romans who believed in reincarnation. And so that's what the biblical author is rejecting. But then there are the other two possibilities, neither of which involves an actual soul moving from one person to another. Those two theories, oh, by the way, I should mention the soul theory is common in the major world religion known as Hinduism. In Hinduism, they refer to the soul as an Atman. That's just their word for soul. But then there are residue theories, and actually the world religion Buddhism has, at least in some of its versions, essentially a residue theory that says, nope, there is no stable soul that passes from one person to another. There is no Atman. And they refer to that doctrine as Anatman. Just like in English, when you stick an "a" on the front of a word, it can mean not. You know, like this is atemporal, meaning it's not temporal. Well, anatman means no atman. And so there, it says there's no stable soul, and instead some kind of residue or something remains of a person, but it's not a soul. And it's that that passes to the new person. In Buddhist literature, this is sometimes compared to one candle lighting another. The candles are distinct objects. You know, one candle is not another candle, but a flame can pass between them. And in the same way, you have two different people who are genuinely different people, but something can pass between them that's responsible for these memories. In some parapsychological literature, you'll find people discussing thought bundles that might pass from one person to another. And so if somebody, let's say, dies a violent death, which is extremely common in these reincarnation cases, way more of the reported cases involve a violent death than you would expect based on how common violent deaths are in the population. Well, maybe if you're dying a violent death, you throw off lots of memory bundles, and these memories are floating out there in the environment, and then a pregnant mom or a small child walks through them, and they pick up these memories that are left over from somebody else, in which case a kind of residue has passed between individuals. Then there are psychic theories, and these basically involve the operation of some kind of psychic power or ESP that would allow information from one person to get to another person. Some of these involve a complex form of ESP where the child would be drawing from multiple different sources and knitting that information together into these memories. And these are sometimes called super psi theories because of how complex the ESP would have to be to pull in all this information from multiple different sources. And the usual criticism of super ESP as an explanation is that it's too complex. And I agree with that. You don't need to propose complex ESP, assuming ESP exists, but then that's what we're trying to do, is explain a paranormal phenomenon here. I propose a theory that I actually haven't seen anyone else propose in episode 276. I propose that you could explain these memories in terms of a simple psychic link between the present person, typically a small child, and the previous person. And all the information just flows through a link between those two people. And I can imagine reasons, assuming psychic functioning exists, which is an assumption that we have to make here in order to consider this possibility. But if psychic functioning exists, I can imagine why such a link would form. If these accounts tend to happen in cultures that believe in reincarnation, like in India, for example, they do happen in other cultures, but they happen most often in cultures that do believe in reincarnation. So let's suppose, Saikelet, you're someone in India, you're a Hindu, you believe in reincarnation, and you're being violently murdered. You're desperate to survive. So being a believer in reincarnation, you might reach forward to some future child and try to impress your identity on that child as a way of surviving. So you might form a psychic link with that child and give them information about yourselves. About yourself.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there it can work the other way potentially, because another characteristic of that's been noted in these cases is the previous person tends to live in a more favorable circumstance than the present person. So like if you're in India, let's say you're a member of the Lal caste, which is a workman's caste. Well, if you're a little Lal child, you could get special treatment if you say, hey, I'm a Brahmin. I'm from the highest caste. So you, my family, need to give me special treatment. And if I can produce memories of a Brahmin that turn out to be accurate, I can convince you and I can get special treatment. And that's going to help me better survive and better flourish. if I'm able to do that. And so there can be a reason why a living child in a reincarnation-believing culture might reach back in time and find someone in a better circumstance that they could say, I'm him, so you owe me better treatment now. So there are, I think, a number of advantages to the psychic link theory. One of them is it explains the cross-cultural differences better than the soul theory or the residue theory, because it turns out that the reincarnation cases that get reported in each culture tend to follow the beliefs of that culture. So, for example, there are cultures that will say things like, this is the case with the Druze, who are kind of an offshoot of Islam in Syria and Lebanon and Israel, places like that. The Druze believe that you reincarnate, but you can only come back as the same sex. They never report coming back as the other sex, and this psychic link theory could explain that. But for more information on all that, check out episode 276 of Mysterious World.
It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots of folks on the line, so more questions for Jimmy right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
When has despair just become too much?
That's tomorrow's topic on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Probably should have before now, but happy Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Thanks for listening on the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the patroness of all of the Americas. We had a little bit of a retreat, and it may seem odd, but it was anything but odd that we went on a retreat with Chaldean priests today and got to celebrate the Mass and the... What do they do? The Eucharistic prayer in Aramaic, right? The language of Jesus. Yeah. And we had a wonderful time, so thank you to the local Chaldean community for letting us have their priests today, and thank you to Mary for converting Mexico and then all of the Americas, basically. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy Akin is our guest. John is in Indiana, and we're glad you're here. John, go ahead with your question.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it. My question is with regard to the Eucharist. And we know the body of Christ is there. Is it the glorified body, or is it perhaps the suffering body of Christ?
According to church teaching, it is the body of Christ glorified. In 1968, Pope Paul VI published a creed known as the Credo of the People of God. And in this creed, it professes that as Christians, as Catholics, we believe that the Eucharist contains the body of Christ now glorified in heaven. So it is Christ's heavenly body up in heaven right now that that becomes present in the Eucharist. Some people have proposed a sort of time warp theory where the Eucharist involves a time warp back to the day of the crucifixion in AD 33. So it would involve Christ's body on the cross when he was suffering. But this time warp theory, although I'm a big fan of time warps, is not something that has historically been contemplated and is actually contradicted by actual church teaching. The church's actual understanding and its actual teaching, as illustrated in the Credo of the People of God, is that it's Christ's glorified body today that is present in the Eucharist.
And was there any reason given by the Pope when he made that declaration?
Well, no, he didn't give a reason because it's a creed, and creeds just explain, here's what we believe. They don't explain why we believe that. But this has been the historic understanding down through Christianity, down through its history. You know, if you went and looked in Aquinas's thought, for example, and his explanation of the real presence, it's not going to involve a time warp. In fact, we really didn't have the idea that space and time could be bent before Albert Einstein at the beginning of the 20th century. He was the one that proposed that space and time are not absolutes, and so you can deform them by things like traveling really fast or getting into a gravity well or things like that. So this was not on the concept of a time warp was not on the intellectual map of theologians down through Christian history. So it's always been understood that it's Christ up in heaven who is appearing in the Eucharist.
John, we will leave it there because the phones are very busy, but thank you very much for that call and for that question. We go to our frequent friend, Emma, in Hayden, Idaho, watching on YouTube. Welcome back, Emma.
Thank you, Si. Thanks for taking my call. So in 2 Kings, it's kind of funny, but it's disturbing at the same time. Mm-hmm. When two boys are calling down to Elisha, you know, calling him Baldy. So mm-hmm. he summons two bears to come eat them. I mean, what's with that?
Well, they don't eat them, but yeah. Also, unfortunately, the translation, this passage as it's commonly translated in English Bibles, I think is potentially a little bit misleading because it in an English Bible, it will refer to these individuals that Elijah calls the bears on as youths or children or boys or things like that. And the Hebrew term actually can include young men. And I think that's part of what is going on here is there's this dynamic between young men who are, you know, young and feeling their oats and feeling, hey, we're young, we're today, we're now. And here's this prophet who's old and decrepit and he's bald. And so you got this young man, old man tension going on here, kind of like the generation gap that people used to talk about here in America, you know, never trust anyone over 30 and stuff like that. It appears, at least according to, and this is a mysterious passage, but it appears that another component of what may be going on here is a challenge to the God of Israel, to Yahweh. And this is not obvious to us English speakers, but there's an evangelical scholar named Michael Heiser who has talked about this, and it looks like there's some evidence that part of what the youth are doing is challenging the God of Israel and through his prophet Elisha, and so one of the aspects that may be present in this text is not only the conflict between youth and age, but between the true religion and paganism. And that then brings another dimension into why Elijah might call upon the bears, not just because he is, or why he might curse the youth and then the bears maul them. They don't actually eat them, but they do attack them and maul them. And if he's been insulted as a prophet, and worse, if God is being insulted, then that's the kind of thing that could result in you getting cursed in the Old Testament and having problems with bears or something else. And so that seems to be, that's my best understanding of what's likely going on in this passage. If you'd like more information about that, as I said, Michael Heiser has talked about this, and you can Google or go on YouTube and put in Elisha, bears, and Michael Heiser, H-E-I-S-E-R. Once again, H-E-I-S-E-R, Michael Heiser.
Okay, Emma.
Thank you.
Emma.
Yes.
You live in grizzly bear country there in Idaho?
No. In the mountains, yeah. They're about 50 miles north of us.
No, I didn't know if you were taking this personally. But all right, thanks, Emma. All right, bye. Let's go to Michelle in Massachusetts, definitely not grizzly bear country, listening on 89.3 FM. Michelle, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, I have a question about St. Mm-hmm. Paul in mm-hmm. Ephesians chapter 4, mm-hmm. verse 22. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. So I have heard a few different interpretations of this passage, and it seems like a lot of people agree that it means that wives are supposed to obey their husbands as their husbands are the heads of household, etc. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that the verse before, verse 21, says, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ.
Yep.
So I kind of feel like the word subject, or be subject to, is talking about everyone, not just wives. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what it means to be subject to. Does that mean to obey, or does it mean something else?
Oh, great.
Well, it incorporates, it can incorporate obedience, but I think that, and it's hard to say, you know, exactly what all the dimensions of this are, because it involves a general principle that's going to apply in different circumstances. One of the things that I think that this passage is reflecting is Jesus's principle that he articulates in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, where he gives a series of illustrations that all involve not pressing your rights. Like if someone insists that you go with him 1 mile, you know, and this was something that Roman soldiers could do. You know, they could impress a civilian into service and make them carry stuff for them for 1 mile. And he says, if someone does that, go with him 2 miles. You know, he doesn't have a right to make you go 2 miles, but you don't have to insist on your rights. Similarly, he says, if someone strikes your right cheek, offer him your left, you know, things like that. And what these illustrations have in common is not insisting on your rights, being generous of spirit and being willing to go the extra mile, to use an expression that has come from this exact passage in Matthew. And so when Paul articulates the general principle in Ephesians of be subject to one another for the sake of Christ, I think what he's doing is reflecting this teaching of Jesus that we shouldn't just cling to our rights. We should be willing to go out of our way for other people and be generous of heart and do things that we don't have to do. Now, And I think that's a general Christian principle that applies to everybody, because Jesus doesn't say, wives, if someone makes you go with them 1 mile, go with them 2. In fact, a Roman centurion probably would not require, or a Roman soldier probably would not require a woman to carry stuff. He's actually going to be doing that of men. And so I think that this general principle of not insisting on our rights and going out of our way to help other people and do things for other people, that applies to everybody. And I think that's part of what Paul is articulating here. Now, that doesn't mean that it has no special application to wives. because in the biblical vision of society, men do have special responsibilities in the family. They do have a distinct role. Christ compares the role of the husband in a family to the role of Christ in relationship to the church. And so, he tells women to, you know, be subject to their husbands the way the church is subject to Christ. But he also turns around and says, and husbands, love your wives and sacrifice yourself for them the way Christ sacrificed himself for the church. So nobody's getting off scot-free here. Being subject to someone also doesn't mean you do absolutely everything they say. If someone gives you makes an unreasonable request or a positively damaging request, well, you don't got to do that. But what Paul is encouraging is a harmonious attitude in which everybody in the church has this attitude of generosity of heart and willing to go out of their way for someone else. And he also applies it concretely in the family. So husbands need to have self-sacrificing love for their wives, which actually requires more of the husband than it does of the wife. You know, wives are not called to sacrifice themselves for their husbands, but husbands are called to sacrifice themselves like Christ did for his church, if that's what's required. So even though this is something that, you know, is a hot button topic in our culture right now, what Paul is ultimately trying to do is paint a vision of social interactions, including within the family, that are reasonable and loving and wholesome and balanced. So nobody is like king of the hill and gets to just do what they want with no restraints and no concern for other people.
Michelle, what do you think?
That was helpful. Thank you. I'm assuming, does the church have specific teaching on this, or is this kind of open to interpretation kind of a topic?
There's considerable flexibility here for different opinions. Historically, right, you would have more emphasis on obedience on the part of the wife, but if you look at recent magisterial documents, like from the time of John Paul II forward, there's more emphasis on balance. And so I would say this is an area where, as society has changed, the church has had to think more carefully about all this, and we haven't yet arrived at a final version of this teaching. And the church is presently allowing exegetes and biblical scholars and theologians to ponder this subject and propose different ways of living out these principles.
Michelle, thank you. That brings us to the break, so we will be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
EWTN's religious catalog has terrific suggestions for Christmas gifts. Women Made New, Reflections on Adversity, Transformation, and Healing by Kristalina Evert features the captivating stories of 12 women who overcame personal trials to become champions for the kingdom of God. The Women Made New book and DVD set is one of many great Christmas gifts from EWTN religious catalog. For more, visit EWTNRC.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest today, both hours, and it's open forum, so perfect time to call because there's a line open. Perfect time to get your question into Jimmy. Anyone's welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, of course, is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and I don't believe I have asked you yet, Jimmy. What's dropping what's dropping on Friday this week?
We're going to be looking at what the historical evidence says about the tomb of Christ. So there are different proposals for where the tomb of Christ is located. You have some scholars, even use the word loosely, who have even proposed that there was no tomb of Christ, that he was just dumped in a common grave, or maybe it was even eaten by wild dogs or something like that after the crucifixion. But then there are other reports of where his tomb would have been, including places as far away as Japan.
Really?
And, yeah.
Wow. Good for Joseph of Arimathea.
Yeah, and and other places you would not expect. So we're going to be taking a look at what the historical evidence says. We're going to be looking at, do we have evidence that he actually was buried in a tomb, including beyond the Gospels? Do we have evidence for where that tomb was? And what about all these alternative proposed sites? And can we establish the site in Jerusalem that can we establish one site in Jerusalem that has the best historical evidence pointing to it as opposed to other sites? And the answer is yes, we can. There are at least three sites in Jerusalem that have been proposed as Jesus's tomb, and the evidence clearly supports one of those three sites over the others.
All right. It drops Friday morning. All you got to do is put in your computer, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and get it where you get podcasts. You can get it on YouTube. Coming this Friday, where's Jesus' tomb? Up next, Kyle in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Kyle, thank you for downloading our app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. So I just kind of wanted to preface my question by saying that I'm a fairly new Catholic. I was baptized back in Easter 2020.
Well, welcome home, brother.
Yeah, thank you. I know. I'm glad to be a part of it. And so one of the things that really got me interested in the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith was the Apocrypha, and that, you know, we have books that aren't included in other Bibles, like Protestants and all that stuff. And so one day I was talking to my friend about it, and he's not baptized, but he's very well-versed in Christianity and the readings and Jesus' teachings and all that. And when I mentioned the Apocrypha to him, he talked about how that was just some books that were kind of just, like, added in later by the Council of Trent, I think it was, just to, you know, fit doctrine or whatever. And so I did some research while I was at my work, and I just had some questions about it. So I guess the first one would be the difference between, what is the Deuterocanon? Because that was one thing that came up a lot, was why do we call it Deuterocanon? And, like, the difference between that and the Apocrypha? And then also, why did it take so long up to, like, the Protestant Reformation for those books to become canonized?
All right.
Okay, so in regard to the first question, the term deuterocanonical is used, or deuterocanonicals, is used in Catholic circles and some other circles for essentially the same books that Protestants refer to as the Apocrypha. The term Apocrypha is essentially the Protestant term for the deuterocanonicals, though there are a few exceptions. There are a few books that are often classified as Apocrypha by Protestants that are not actually in the Catholic canon. And some of them are in, you know, some Eastern Orthodox canons, but they're not considered canonical by Catholics. And so, with the exception of like three or four books, the Deuterocanonicals and the Apocrypha are the same thing. They include the same book. So that's 1 Maccabees, 2 Maccabees, Tobit, Judith, Esther, Baruch, and the Deuterocanonical portions of Daniel and Esther, as well as Wisdom of Solomon and Sirach. We're essentially talking about the same set of books with a few exceptions. In terms of being canonized, well, actually, no, they were canonized earlier. Canonization is a process whereby a book is recognized as being canonical, and these books had a long history of being recognized as canonical. What happened, though, and that, you know, we can show that, for example, that they were considered canonical by looking at councils that occurred towards the end of the 300s, like the Council of Rome in the year 382. It included the deuterocanonicals. So did the councils of more than one council of Carthage and the Council of Hippo. These all occurred in the late 300s and the beginning of the 400s. And these were local councils, but they recognized these books as canonical. And so they considered them part of the canon. So they had been canonized in the view of these different local councils, which represented churches over, you know, broad swaths of territory, both in the Italian peninsula and also in North Africa. And these reflected the common opinion of Christians all over the place. If you look, for example, at the book Early Christian Doctrines by the Protestant scholar J.N.D. Kelly, he notes that the canon, with very few exceptions, was always considered as including more than what's in the Protestant Old Testament. It also included these deuterocanonical works. Now, that didn't mean everybody agreed, because this had not yet been infallibly defined. And so, you know, there were individuals here and there that had their own views on this. But broadly speaking, these were recognized by Christians in general as being part of the canon. Then in the 1400s, at the Council of Florence, there was an attempt made to reconcile with some Eastern Christians who did not recognize these books. And so the Council of Florence spelled out a list of books in the canon that included them. And so this was not an infallible decree. At least it's arguably not an infallible decree, but it did list these. And then in the 1500s, you had Protestantism began, and all of a sudden you had a major movement that was denying the canonicity of these books. Well, that went in the face of the fact these books had been accepted broadly by Christians all the way down through history. And all of a sudden you have a big movement saying these are not scripture. And it was at that point that the church felt the need to infallibly define this. They'd already been canonized earlier, but now the church was doing it infallibly so that there would be no doubt in Catholic circles that these are part of the Bible. And so that's why Trent infallibly defined them. There's more to say about all this, but we're getting close to the end of the hour. So what I'd like to do, Kyle, is send you a copy of a book that I wrote all about the history of the Bible, including these parts. It's called The Bible is a Catholic Book. And if you hang on the line, then we'll send you a copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book, and you can read more about all this history.
Kyle, thanks. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Rob in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube. Rob, we are coming near the end of the hour. Can you be quick with your question for Jimmy?
I can be quick. First of all, love you guys. It's good to once again be speaking to Gandalf the Red and the venerable Saint Cy, but I will make this fast. I love
Please
the way
do.
You do things. You can do things basic, Jimmy. So could you explain to us a feast day? What are you supposed to feast on? Is it food or the subject matter of the day? Is there procedures to feast day, feast days?
Okay. Rob, okay. I'm going to let him answer because we're coming up on the hour here.
So a feast day historically was a day on which you would feast on food. And if you want to feast on food on a feast day, you can do that. These days, what's required is certain adaptations in the liturgy that are meant to encourage the faithful to remember whatever the feast is celebrating and contemplate its spiritual significance. So if you want to observe a feast day, one way of doing that is go to Mass, participate in the liturgy, including the Liturgy of the Hours, contemplate whatever it is that the feast day is celebrating. If you want to eat special food on that day, you can do that. If it's a holy day of obligation, there are a few more things like you got to go to Mass and you should rest from anything that will interfere with your enjoyment of the day, if possible. But just in terms of a plain old regular feast day, if you want to celebrate it voluntarily, contemplate the mystery of the day or the saint of the day and their spiritual significance, and participate in the liturgy if you can.
Thanks, Rob. Great question for the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is not a holy day of obligation here in the U.S. I don't know if it is anywhere. And
maybe great, Mexico.
Maybe Mexico, yeah. That brings us to the top of the hour. We'll take a very quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. Couple lines open, 888-318-7884.